This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. In the studio with me today, Kevin Heaney, the remarkable Kevin Heaney. He's a psychotherapist, and his specialty has been in two places. One is he's a specialist around alcoholism and substance abuse, with a long history, having worked at St. Luke's Roosevelt, Beth Israel Hospital, Smithers, now the Addiction Institute, and has also been trained substantially in family therapy and individual therapy with some of the best names out there. Kevin's a good man. He's a man I like personally, and I've invited him on to talk to us about some of the stuff he knows. Kevin, welcome to WBAI.
It's great to be here.
Let's go straight to attunement and validation. You say two of the most important concepts to influence your life, your practice, have been the concept of attunement and validation. Can we talk about that a bit?
Absolutely. First of all, Armand, it is my belief that most people are suffering from a disconnect. They are not feeling heard, they're not feeling connected, they're not feeling part of. And in the incredibly intimate experience of the consultation room, in therapy, people are coming because there's something missing that they might feel from the environment, from the world, really from themselves. And I believe the incredibly important job for the therapist is to bridge that gap and let the individual know that they are heard, first of all, that what they say is important and that they're being attended to.
Okay, so we're talking about what a person needs to do in therapy, but before, let's take it out of the therapeutic room for a minute.
Oh, all right.
Okay, because a lot of people could do this with their husbands and wives, too. What is attunement and validation as it relates to just being before the therapeutic environment?
Well, in point of fact, if the individual could receive that at home with wife, with husband, with parents, with coworkers, they probably would not be needing to look to us in the therapeutic environment. But this is not to say, as your point is making, this isn't a skill or a pattern or a way of communicating that's restricted to trained therapists. What it is an attention to and a focus on the individual, being with them without judgment. Being with them in a way that supports them, that lets them know, I'm here for you. It's nothing that's absolutely out of the ordinary. This is something that's available that we see all the time, but like a great ingredient in cooking, if it's not there, the flavor of the dish, the flavor of the experience, the flavor of the relationship is lacking. An example might be parent and child situation. Father or mother sitting at home, child, kid comes home, brings in a report card or an event, something where the performance, they messed up. They didn't get the grade you wanted or they got in trouble. Validation is the parent pausing and taking in what the child has to say, hearing it, and not just hearing the words to then quickly operate, move to what am I going to do, how am I going to punish, how am I going to change this, but really going inside and being in the skin of the person and saying, oh, because the kid in front of you teases you, because you can't stop him from doing that, it builds, you get frustrated, you get sad, you get angry, and this resulted in you lashing out and picking a fight with him or teasing him back. I hear you, son. I hear you, daughter.
Well, let's try it. I'll be the kid comes home with a bad report card. And really the reason I got the bad report card is because I was out with my friends getting stoned and hanging out and doing what all of we 15-year-old kids do. So look, I got these bad marks because the kid in front of me was distracting me. I feel very bad about it, Dad.
What's going on in the classroom? What's going on with you and this kid? How does he get on your nerves? I need to know more, because I want to understand what's happening for
you. But if
you,
I'm going to take you in the direction of this kid, I'm meaning to take you off the fact that it's really my responsibility. Is validation validating the story that a person brings you regardless of whether it's valid or not?
The fact is, if that's all that's being offered by anyone, is just, I understand why you did that. That's giving permission for someone to fail. That's actually, in many ways, crueler than not offering help, is reinforcing a bad habit, a bad tendency. And I think
what you're saying is very interesting here. You're saying, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, do.
You're saying if no matter what they bring you, you're going to take it as the truth, not necessarily the truth. You may have your skepticism about it, but you're going to work with what they bring you because this is where you're going to show them that they could be heard.
This is exactly the point. And let's make it even more specific. I'm going to take it as their truth. It may not be the truth, court of law, objective reasoning truth, but it's the truth that they were operating on that was informing them. Now, that's assuming, of course, that the kid came home with bad grades because there was this issue with someone else, not because he got stoned, he doesn't care, and he's giving up.
Well, what if it's a lie? Why don't we treat it as a truth anyway?
Well, that's exactly the point. It is their truth. And the fact of the matter is, in order for me to engage someone, in order for a parent to engage, you've got to travel with them the route that they're going for a while.
Well, you know, it reminds me of when police pull over somebody. They pull over a suspect on the side of the road who looks suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, what are you doing on the side of the road here with the alcohol in your car and so on? You were driving sideways and a car is stolen. And the person makes up a story. And the trained policemen don't refute the story. They want the story. And the way that they get that person to cooperate, even to the point where that person will cooperate by putting themselves in jail, is to validate them, mm-hmm. to validate them as people, because they are people. And the best of the cops out there validate the person. They don't care if the story's true or not. They're saying, okay, you're a guy in trouble.
You're bringing up a great point. Communication means that there's someone pitching and someone catching. And in order to have a real catch, you don't just throw the ball once and it's caught and then you keep it. I mean, it's a back and forth. And to build a relationship, there has to be a back and forth. And it really requires maybe going out on a ledge in the sense of, this doesn't sound right to me. BS, I'm not going along with you. It's moving in, starting where the person's at, and really hearing where they're at, not just what the words are.
Well, wait, let me understand then. When would you be going out on a ledge and telling them this is BS?
No,
you wouldn't do that.
What I'm saying is that the going out on the ledge is hearing the story out, hearing it fully, not just the words, really letting it sink in and putting myself in their shoes. What would the experience be like for them? What is it you're telling me?
And what's it like to be heard by somebody, you know, on the other side of it, to actually have somebody listening to you and hearing what you have to say? That's quite an experience for most people because most people don't get that in life.
I would say that most people would tell you, of course, I'm heard. I don't buy it.
So people need to be heard, is what you're saying. And the need to be heard goes all the way back to early childhood for most people. Most people don't have parents who listen, do they?
I would say absolutely not. Not in the way that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm going to add something, Armand. Most people need to hear. It's not just being heard. There's that line from Shakespeare, the quality of mercy is not strained, it falleth as the gentle rain. It blesses the one who receives it and the one who gives it. Mm-hmm. That it is absolutely, if there's enough time, we can talk about another form of family therapy that I've used, where the purpose is to help to train the couples to do just this. Not because it's important to understand, rather to get the story, but the understanding, the creating of a receptive atmosphere where you can tell me and I'm really going to hear you.
Now, when most parents listen to their children, they have something running around in their head while the kid is talking because the kid's reality is something like, oh, mommy, you know, I saw this truck and I got really scared. I want to get that for myself. I want to go to Toy Town and get this present.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a parent, when you're really validating the child, you're not letting them know that this present is important. You're letting them know that you understand their need. How do you do that? I mean, when a kid is asking for something unreasonable, or when somebody's asking something unreasonable of you.
I think one of the areas where we've seen this country move into a very dangerous situation is that we think the thing that expresses a feeling, a caring, the emotion of love, the responsibility of a parent or a partner, wife, husband, when we think the thing is the same thing as the deep emotion, the deep feeling, the spiritual value, if you will, that it represents. So we are a society where the toy is that you can buy people with things, with toys, with the right tight jeans, with racing cars, you name it. But in fact, what are people hungry for? Hungry for something deeper, something that doesn't fit in a box, that you can't write on, something that if it's absent, we are aware of it. We may not be aware on a conscious level, but somebody knows there's something wrong with the marriage. Kids who are saying there's something wrong, my dad isn't here. I've got all the things, but I don't have my dad's attention.
So when a child comes to you asking for a present and saying they must have it because all the other kids have it, you're saying, as you look at this child has a need. You're saying that to yourself, but the child can't express it because they don't even know their need.
Absolutely. The child may not be able to express it. The child may not be aware of it. And in fact, as we know from human relations, knowing something doesn't necessarily bring the relief. There are times that a parent has to set limits. The word no needs to be introduced, but it needs to be done in a way that isn't what you're requesting of me, what you want, this big bright truck or this new cell phone is not, that I'm not invalidating you. I'm not throwing you away, but I cannot give in to your request. I understand it's so important in the junior high school that you have the same one that all of the other kids do. It's so important that they have this, that they fit in, that they're the same as good as, or even better, that to appreciate what's driving it underneath and to hear that the request is a request for something more. That doesn't mean it's going to be given.
So in most couples, you know, after a while, you get tired of hearing the stuff when you have somebody who's complaining all the time or aggravated all the time. And after a while, you know, in most relationships, people tune out.
Mm-hmm.
They tune out to the words, because I think what you said before about what's happened in our society is valid, that they tune out to the words because the words have... they're repetitive. They're not saying the need and the feeling that's underneath it. When you are listening to someone and when you hear the complaint over and over again, you can either tune out, as most people do, or you could try to address the issue. Now, mm-hmm. Addressing the issue, I think, would come something more like when a person says to you, I'm so sick and tired of this country and the way that they elect these critical people. You would have to address it almost like you need a therapist for that, because most wives or husbands can't see underneath the words that a person is saying. We could. You and I would. We would be able to say, it looks like you feel really lonely and depressed. But we would know that. But most people don't know that when they're talking to their mates. They hear these words. And the trouble is that the words are something that can become repetitive and people get tired of. And so it's very hard to validate them.
Absolutely.
That's why you need a therapist.
Well, you need a therapist who can listen, or you may need a therapist who can teach you to listen, which is really much more ideal.
Uh-huh.
So that the couple or the family or the individual isn't just better in my office or your office, but that they're taking this away.
Well, let's talk a minute about you as a family therapist, because
yes,
this is one of your great skills and one of the things I know you trained with some of the people that I really respect the most in the field. What is it about in your work? What is it about the work with Salvatore Mnuchin that you do? What you got the most out of that training?
Frankly, it was his directness, and this is going to sound terrible, but I was classically trained in the analytic mode, in the psychodynamic mode, where the question of accountability often seemed to get lost. A lot of people in the field, the professionals, seem to just be generating more excuses and more hall passes, if you will, for letting people get away with things that they shouldn't get away with.
What people in what field?
I'm speaking of the psychologists, psychiatrists,
what
social
would they,
workers.
What would they let people get away with?
Armand, I think the individual thinks of the classic...
Back it up. Erase that. He can't do another Armand because we're going to lose it. Try it again. Okay, so we're
Armand.
Gonna... Thank you.
Armand, think of the outrage and the irritation.
The question, I'm going to do the question over.
Okay.
Letting people get away with things. What is it that people get away with when they're in therapy? I mean, who lets what get away with what?
The therapist, obviously, is the person who chiefly is going to let the individual, the patient, the client, whatever you want to call it, get away with things by not introducing a reality, not introducing a timetable for change, not introducing, helping the patient, the client, whatever we want to call it, the person looking for help, by not allowing them to clearly identify what they are not happy with, not comfortable with, and what they would like to see change occur.
So there's a structure in the in this method. There's a structure that says, hey, wait a minute. Let's not just slide by the way we used to, because the therapists are out there. If somebody wants to come in and pay them and then tell them stories about their boyfriends, you know, the therapist takes the pay and he lets it slide by. Or if a person says, I'm really feeling fine and I can't come in today, the therapist just lets it happen. You're saying there's more accountability, and therefore, with this accountability, you got this idea more from working with Mnuchin. Is that what you're saying?
He was able to raise the question of why is this little child the one who is controlling a whole family? There were times he would use a dramatic enactment. He would have the troublesome, difficult third grader stand up next to the parent and say, how is it possible that this little one is controlling this entire family or controlling you? And the dramatic experience, first of all, of seeing it, because we change when we experience things differently. Ideas are great. Ideas flow back and forth. You can buy all the ideas you want. But to experience freedom, opportunity, the ability to shift, seed something in the individual, I can be different.
Well, I'm still back with this family. I got this
image in my mind. Back with the family. Suddenly the mother is seeing, this is crazy. This is a little child. This is my baby. I can set limits. I can say
well,
no.
Well, how would Mnuchin set up a structure so that that could be explored?
He would literally start by breaking the cycle, the pattern that's been going on and on.
Describe it to me physically. What would he do? Would he come in with a hammer and break a pattern? No, describe what he would do. He would use a chair. He would use a technique.
The technique would be literally in the session, in the room, having the whole family there, literally pulling the mother, not pulling, but inviting the mother to stand up, come into the center of the room in the circle of chairs with the whole family, and having this troublesome third grader step forward and asking the question, how is this little one being so powerful? Isn't this a child? Aren't you the adult? Who is bigger? Who is stronger? Who's got the checkbook? Really reinforcing with the parent, at the same time setting up with the child a hierarchy. You're the child. You need to go back to being a child. Parent, adult, you need to reassume your responsibility of being a grown-up. This is the right relationship, and the problem is you've moved away from that. That doesn't mean you don't listen, of course, but that you are not controlled by, give me this, give me that, that the third grader might say, or I can't do this, I can't do that.
When you know, one of the questions I have, and maybe you could help me with this, Kevin. Oh, by the way, our guest is Kevin Heaney. He's a family therapist, also a specialist in alcoholism and drug abuse, but he's a remarkable therapist who's recently become an associate of mine. Kevin, in working with families, right, so often I find that the designated patient, could we talk a little about the designated sick one in a
Absolutely.
Family, that concept?
Let's
Let's talk about that.
You're raising what is a fundamental concept to those who've studied family systems. And this was one of the other great contributions.
When we say family systems, we're calling it family systems theory, which is what the Mnuchin school was kind of titled, right?
Actually, his would be the structural family, but the concept we moved into was trying to understand families as a system.
Okay.
That a system, and there are other theorists who came with this, but they're, let me just say that it's conceiving that there's a relationship within the system, that the components, the parts, the mother, father fit together in the same way that you think of a radiator in a house with central heating, the way you think of electronics, and that when the system goes out of balance, the individual suffers, and that the overall system can be treated, and that the person who presents with the problem, the teenager who's cutting school or getting into using drugs, the person who is physically losing control and battering, may not be, in fact, the most disturbed person in the system, is what we call the identified patient, the one who is sent out to be fixed.
And very often that person could be, like, I remember in the studies with children with leukemia at Bellevue, they had children, parents who had children who had leukemia. One of the things that they found a great deal was that the for as long as the child was there and sick, as soon as the child died, the family divorced. The parents divorced. And it was a high rate of divorce among people whose child died of leukemia. And the reason being that the designated problem was the child, and they never got a chance to look at themselves. Had they had Kevin Heaney around, they would have examined their own relationship as well, and perhaps not needed to separate as they were going through this trying time. So the designated patient, the designated sick one in a family, is usually the one who seems to be the problem to everybody. You all have that somewhere in your family. There must be one person. It might be you. It could be your cousin. It could be your mother. It could be your sister. It could be the one person who seems to be. Now, what Kevin is saying is, according to systems theory, what we understand is that if one piece is broken, perhaps there are other pieces along the way that are sometimes even more broken. A woman came in to see me today, and she talked to me about her dysfunctional son. And I asked her about her feelings, and she said she never allows herself to cry. And so I heard that in my head, and I'm saying, all right, I got a dysfunctional son, and I got a mother who's... I said to her, you know, I think maybe you should come back and talk to me. She said, why me? My son is the one who's got what's wrong. And I heard it, and I explained it to her this way. I said, sometimes you have a car that no matter what you do, it keeps turning in the wrong direction. And you want to go fix the car, right? So you're going to take every part of it, but sometimes it's just one wheel that you have to look at. Maybe you got to fill the air. Maybe you got to do something with it. I said, in this case, maybe you're a wheel, and everybody else is too. So I got her to come back because I've got to get her to relieve some of her pressure, because I believe what's happening for her is her son is taking the pressure off her by being the designated sick one. Very often, people become designated sick people to save their parents, to save their mothers and fathers from having to deal with their own reality. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. We see over and over again that the individual who is making the squeaky wheel that's needing the most oil often is not the wheel that's the most out of alignment. And in fact, for the average person, this is going to sound like hogwash. And I can understand it. It was certainly challenging to me when the idea was presented. But the more and more time that was spent looking at this, that if the whole system is rebalanced, the individual who is the problem presenter, the squeaky wheel, if you will, often gets better and gets better quickly. An interesting point, the way some of this family system was developed, was going back to when people would be put into hospitals for being schizophrenic, for having a massive mental illness, which we now understand is quite genetic, is quite a chemical problem. We've seen considerable strides with medication. The individual would be in the hospital and would be doing very well. Visiting day would come, and the patient would decline. Now, this resulted in a kind of false direction, thinking that the mother was the one who was responsible. But in fact, what happened was, as the individual was put back in contact with the place that manufactured the problem, where there was tension within the family, then the individual started to act out again. The squeaky wheel got squeakier. Now, I want to be very clear about this. The other part that I found so exciting was the positive direction the positive orientation that the family therapy offered, that the family systems offered, which was going against the grain of what was being said so much in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, we're going to go there in just a second. I want to complete this idea because we're building a picture here for people.
Okay.
There is a family. In every family, family systems theory says the following, and I'm going to reiterate it, about the designated sick person. You may have been told in your family that you've been the one who've been wrong, but you may have somebody in the family who's sick. Or we're saying that the illness very often is a manifestation of a need for some kind of a valve in the family.
Exactly.
Because there's a pressure elsewhere, and that a child could be born and could somehow see his mother's sense of meaninglessness and could therefore become a problem to his mother so his mother could focus all her attention on him. His purpose in life becomes to make his mother feel meaningful, and that it becomes his designated role. He almost doesn't have a personality. What we then see is somebody who's got inadequate personality functioning and a mother who sits there always worrying about her son. When we look at it through the family systems style, we would say, well, maybe mom has to explore herself. Now, this is difficult because most elders, most parents of dysfunctional children only want to blame the child. They don't want to look at themselves. They say, what do you mean me? What do you mean I cause it? What do you mean I have problems? They want to duck it like crazy. The beauty of the work that Sal did and you do is that you don't let them get away with this. You say, no, look, we've got to do it. We're going to nail it down. This is where it is. Now I'm going to carry this over just because I'm sure the same kind of thing takes place with your other specialty, which has to do with alcoholism and substance abuse.
Actually, if I can just jump in for a second.
Sure.
There's something very important that has to be said, which is the sickest person is often the person whose role is to fix the family.
Right.
And the role in fixing the family is often by being the one who becomes the problem and distracts the attention, pulls the depression, the anxiety, the tension away from whatever else is wrong, and they become the one who holds the bag for the family. So they, in fact, are noble, if you will, because they're taking the focus away. They're the ones who take the fall, if you will, for what's going on in the family. Getting the family to accept I may have some problems, too, requires an incredible skill. It requires that the therapist is constantly connecting, being attuned, and validating everyone who's sitting in the room. Because if dad, in fact, is the one who really has a significant problem, work pressures are driving him crazy, he's just not available for anyone. If I lose dad and dad says this is nonsense and gets up and storms out of the room and never comes back, nothing's been accomplished. So the challenge is that the therapist, someone in my role or your role, has to actively keep everyone bought in on some level.
It's so hard because, as you know, you're really like reining wild horses. It's really like trying to keep the, because everybody wants to escape that reality. But let's say it's not about therapy. Here we are. I mean, we know because this is what we do for a living.
Right.
But if you're in a family, and as Kevin says, if you're in a family where you have this fixer, he says the fixer, the one with the strongest need to fix, is usually the one with the highest level of repressed disturbance, of deepest amount of disturbance. And think about that in your family, friends. Think about your mother, your father, the fixers, your sister, your brother, the fixers. Think about them and think about their needs. And then think about what would happen if they stopped fixing. Very often I have people who come to see me who I say, okay, you gotta not offer any suggestions and not fix and see what happens. And it takes a person to dig all the way down. Well, then what am I if I'm not a fixer? And the question, what am I, is a very big question. Because all you have is I'm a fixer and I can't fix it and I'm going to keep fixing it and keep fixing it. We're going to take a short break, play you a little music, and when we come back, we'll continue with our discussion.
Some time in our lives, we all have pain, we all have sorrow.
This is Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. In the studio with me, Kevin Heaney. In this position, Kevin, we get this need to kind of examine this in some way. And is it now I want to take this on to with alcoholism and drug abuse when we have family system. Why do they invite families to be part of a treatment for a substance abuse?
Well, for the longest time, the family was not necessarily seen as needing to be present. And there are a number of reasons why. First of all, is it efficient? It is cost reductive. There are good reasons for doing it. The person who manufactured the problem, the mother, father, sister, uncle, aunt, who put this together, if they don't change, the likelihood is that the individual will be pulled back, sometimes subtly, sometimes directly, into the kind of pattern that we're trying to change. Do I mean to say that someone walks home from having tried to get treatment for, say, drinking or using cocaine, and that the family's going to hand them the drug, hand them the drink? Well, in fact, yes. At times, that happens. At other times, there is a failure for the family to understand the kind of pressure, the kind of difficulty that the individual is going through. So they're really not in touch, not aware, not attuned to the individual, and they can create a pressure cooker which puts the individual in the situation where they feel they've got to get high, have a drink in order to be able to cope, or they get so frustrated that they get blown out. So there are a variety of ways that the family, which really is the place that this is coming from, that the individual is coming from, if there isn't some education, some healing, some putting out the fire for the family, the likelihood is greater, not all the time, but certainly greater, that the individual will not be able to be successful or will have to disengage, disconnect, walk away, move out, because they can't be in that family that's generated this, that's created this kind of world.
Well, you've worked in both inpatient and outpatient treatment facilities with substance abuse.
Yes.
Have there been family therapy sessions required as part of an inpatient treatment? Is that the way it works?
In fact, at Beth Israel's Stuyvesant Square system, it was required if the individual was going to go into the inpatient program, this is some years ago, that they had to sign on that the family would be brought in. And the family was given an extensive 4 days, full days of treatment to help them understand addiction, to understand how addiction affected the individual, their loved one, the addict, the alcoholic, and even more importantly, how the addiction affected them. Armand, there's a phrase that's used, Armand, in the chemical dependency field. They talk about addiction, alcoholism, as being a family disease. The fact of the matter is, any disease is always a family disease. If you have someone in your family who has cancer, the whole family has cancer. As the individual worsens or hopefully gets better, the family goes through the roller coaster ride, the emotional roller coaster ride of, is mom going to get better? Is grandpa going to die? And in fact, it changes the whole system. If mom's no longer there to cook, clean, organize the house, somebody's got to take over. The whole family is affected. The same thing applies, obviously, with addiction, which is another disease. You don't just contaminate some of the well. You poison the well, the whole well gets poisoned. The whole family is worsened.
Well, what if you don't have the family available? What if you only have one or two parts that are available? Is it possible? I mean, when you're working with somebody, if they don't have anybody in their family who wants to cooperate?
If you have no one who wants to cooperate, then obviously, if no one's going to receive the
letter. What if only one parent wants to? What do you do?
I would work with whoever is present, whoever is willing, with the possibility that if it's successful and if I or the worker is good at it, they may draw them in.
Okay, so if you have Kevin, if you have somebody who comes in and says I've got this substance problem or this addiction problem, and here are my parents. Now we're not doing therapy like you do family therapy, because with substance abuse counseling you're doing a different thing, right? We're not looking at the underpinnings of the psyche of the parents. Family therapy is a different thing. You might have to uncover a lot of stuff. But in addiction treatment, where you're using the family as part of a support, I mean, you're not really doing in-depth therapy on the family, are you, on the individuals?
You're not going to be doing it immediately. It may evolve into that if this is an ongoing. But certainly what you want to do is rebalance the family so that it... Let me just say this. The family therapy approach starts with the presumption, the reality that families have been manufacturing human beings for millennium, for millions of years. If it weren't for family, we wouldn't be here. And there's been a bad rap given to family, that family's just a source of problems. So if it weren't for the family, I wouldn't have this. If it weren't for my mother, if my father was different, that's not true. But the goal of family treatment is to get the family back to doing what it does well, which is generate life, the next generation, support the generation that's here, take care of the aging generation. The problem is that our family, it's a great institution, but it needs some help. On an individual basis, I'm not waving any political stance, but the American family is not able to do what it should do. And we see figures, I'll spare that, but there are figures that show the family is in need of help. Why should we help the family? Because the family is where the health is going to come from. The family can be not a source of pathology, an incredible source of strength and shape, hope and change. So going back...
Do you think... I'm sorry, I know just another thought flashed through. If somebody is alienated from their mothers or fathers so that they don't talk to their mothers and fathers, if somebody comes to you and says, oh, I don't talk to my mother or father at all, do you think that person could possibly live a happy life?
Without ever connecting with the family again? If that is not possible, I think the...
How would it not be possible?
How would it not be possible?
Yeah, let's say you had a father who is alcoholic or he's got some problems and you just don't like being around him anymore and you disown him. Doesn't that do something in you that makes it so difficult for you to be in this world?
I would agree. I would agree with you completely. But I'm of the opinion we don't have to like everyone.
Not like them.
but it is necessary on some level to love them. I think that there is...
That's beautifully said. Could you give me that one just a little? Give me that again.
The behaviors that you and I or anyone are going to run into, the type of rudeness, the type of rejection, the type of harshness. And look, when we talk about family, we're certainly bringing up issues of sexual abuse, of violence, of neglect, things which are criminal activities and which we've become much more sensitive to not permitting if we detect it. But I believe that in the end, and forgive the opinion, that the individual cannot be a whole integrated person with having these deep reservoirs of rage, hurt, resentment. So I'm not approving of or permitting the violence, the abuse, the neglect. But the individual, I believe, can rise up in their personhood to some level of not permitting the behavior, condemning the behavior, but not condemning the individual, of finding some way, and this is superhuman, but yes, it's going beyond human, to a transcendent position where you make peace, which is not to say that you allow the enemy or the parent or the son to do it again, but that's the difference between tough love and an enabling, permissive, let them run away with it.
Well, I like the way you say it. You know, it's not important to like them, but it is important to love them. And what that means is to embrace it in some way. But here comes this other issue. If you meet, say you're somebody who's a single person and you meet somebody who says, I hate my father. I can't get along with my father. I never want to be with my father. You know that person's going to be a troubled person. You just kind of know it. If a person is spewing vehemence right from the beginning of meeting them, you know, that's enough evidence right there. Okay, you got a problem. If you walk around telling other people that you feel that way, you've got a problem. That everybody should be able to resolve that enough so that they don't bring it into their relationships, because whatever feelings you have about your parents, you're going to bring into your relationship. Whatever's unresolved, it's going to come creeping in all the time. I'm sure that's what you uncover a great deal in the family sessions, isn't it?
That is certainly some of what is. The fact that these tendencies, these trends, follow us everywhere. I mean, the great story of the gal or the guy who's had five marriages, and they say five different bodies, but the same marriage to the same type of person. We're all looking in some way to get healed, to get fixed, to get ourselves right. And the way we do it sometimes isn't so sensible.
And we try through repetitions. What about attunement? Is that the same, the word attunement, as it was used by them? What does that mean?
I would make that a little bit more subtle, a little bit more internal, a little bit more about taking the temperature and being in touch with the type of feeling that the individual is having, and doing so in a way that really lets me resonate with it and appreciate what is taking place. There's a certain thing that's described that it's a classic line from the therapy going all the way back to the psychodynamic, that the certain glow in the eye that a parent has as they look at a child, and that sense of being received positively, no matter what I'm thinking, no matter what I'm feeling, and that maybe I can't express what's going on, but the person sitting opposite me is present, is listening, is not looking to fix me, judge me, put me away, but is there with me. It is an incredible experience. If you've had it once, it's like the taste of chocolate.
Well, since we do dramatic radio here, aren't we doing it right this second? You know, since I've met you, that's what I noticed about you, how attuned you were to me and how attuned I was to you. And even now as we speak, even as we're doing radio and we're doing a function, I sense you. I'm aware of you. I'm conscious. And I'm aware of your being aware of me. See? And I see that goes beyond the words. So validation is one thing, where you speak words that say, okay, I get you. Attunement is allowing yourself to enter the field with the other person and say, okay, I'm with you. I'm with you. We're partners. You know, we're here together. And they could feel it, and you could feel it. It's not just in a mother's eyes. is in every person's eyes who takes the time to virtually attune. You know? I guess that's why they call it, if you're crazy, it's Looney Tunes.
The one thing that I really want to point out is that this is something I believe we're all capable of. But it's a bit exhaustive. You know, it's the type of thing that any one of us can say when a partner, boss, coworker is saying, you're not listening to me. Of course I'm listening to you as I'm dialing into my iPhone, as I'm selecting something, watching the TV over their shoulder at the restaurant. That's the more obvious example. But the subtlety of sitting and being with someone, even if it's briefly, hearing, and then allowing it to hit into me. So if you're telling me about how hard the last year was for you with your taxes or your back injury or your mother-in-law, that I'm feeling it. Attunement is not just that I hear it, it's allowing it to, the dart to hit the target. And you really know that the person's with you, that they're not just absorbing your words or just letting you talk and get it off your chest, but that it's coming on to them. It's not easy, but it's a profoundly changing thing. We see it in film. We hear about it in literature. I'm not sure if all of us get to experience it or get to try for it.
Well, you know, part of the beauty of our work is if you do it, if you do this work, one of the chances you get is you get the chance to tune into each person. But now, you said it's exhaustive. So there you are, a therapist, right? And here you are, a successful therapist with people coming to counsel with you because they know they're going to get embraced and not physically, but embraced emotionally, and that you're going to give them a great deal. But you put out such energy during each session, and your energy is an energy of attunement, which you said is exhaustive. Could be, especially since the person's very often avoiding the very involvement. They're kind of, you know, darting right and left and talking about everything else while you're there tuning in.
Yes, yes.
How do you do it? How do you not exhaust yourself over a period of time? Or is there something about it that's regenerative? Is there something about it that's energizing?
Both are true. I think the fact of the matter is that, let's take up the last point, there is an energy exchange, and it can be incredibly uplifting, incredibly electrifying when it's happening. It can be frustrating when it's not happening. I think it requires, so that the process, if done right, both parts benefit. The person coming with the problem and the person hearing the problem. There is, of course, the need for self-care. And in fact, I think a lot of the folks in the field don't necessarily take the time. You can't do this, you know, the same as a baseball player couldn't do game after game after game without some downtime. There's a need to heal self, to fix self, to get the inner resources recharged in any number of ways. And that business of how could I possibly sit opposite you and receive this if I'm not taking good care of me? But of course, we know that that's a phenomenon that exists for all professionals. You know, doctors, physician, heal thyself is an ancient phrase, but I know from my practice,
well,
not a lot do.
There's two ways to attune. One way is the short-term attunement. You know, it's short-term. I'm here for 45 minutes, a half hour. I'm tuned into you absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things about me being in the field for so long is I have so many tools and I have access to so much information that when a person comes to see me, boom, I zero in. Because I know I'm only zeroing in. I'm seeing people for one time only. I'm not seeing people on an ongoing basis like you are. And that is, it's energizing to me. It's exciting. It's like a detective story. But I'm there 100% and people could feel it. But if I did that, and when I used to do that for client after client, when I used to see people and the same people would come back every week and I had a caseload, I felt the exhaustiveness of it after a number of years. That's why over the last few years I said, no, I don't see people individually anymore on an ongoing basis. I've done a lot of that. Now what I'll do is I'll see people one time because I don't have that wherewithal to want to do that, to want to get into that. You do. You do. You know, you have that. The other people I work with, they have that. Me, I'm saying, okay, no, no, you get one. But that thing that you put out, that energy you put out, is really a valuable, beautiful thing for people. And me, I'm feeling like it's in limited supply. I'm going to keep it for myself.
Well, A, thank you for the compliment. And B, I think the self-awareness is vital. You know, if it's too hot, maybe you shouldn't be in the kitchen, or maybe you shouldn't be in the kitchen so long. And I think that there are times with emotional states or physical health issues that come up where people should realistically look at how much can I be doing and am I helpful. The other problem is taking too much on. In the end, it's a what they call a parallel process. There's the part I have to do and the part that the individual or the couple or the family has to do. And if I confuse what's my role, what's my work versus what they need to do, much as I'd like everyone to leave getting better, that there are times that the sad reality of human existence is sometimes people need to suffer more. Maybe not yet, or even worse, maybe not this time around. But hope is incredibly important. It doesn't have to be so. But the individual therapist, psychotherapist, counselor needs to take care of themselves, be realistic, as well as get that recharge. And some of what I find that's important to me and it's changed over the years, and it's been more years than I want to admit, is being able to be real with a person.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of classic psychodynamic solid wall, I'm much more present. There are photographs and oil paintings that reflect who I am. I'll tell you things about myself. I no longer see it as so valuable. I see the close human connection. People change because of people. And I sometimes am not ready to be a person in the room. Of course, there's professional limitations. There's restraint. All of this is called for. But being able to be more real has made it buzz more.
Well, you see, that's the beauty of you, Kevin. We're speaking with Kevin. I'm very impressed by his depth, beauty, and realness. And we've got quite a bit to teach. We're going to be continuing, and we'll be doing more programs like this, Kevin. I really appreciate your candor and your honesty with us. If you wanted to get in touch with Kevin, you could do it through me at positivemind.com, and we'll just forward it on. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We will be back with you soon, my friends. Be sure to tune in. We have a lot of upcoming exciting stuff. We're going to have to be going. We'll be back with you soon. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're making a lot of changes here. WBAI is moving uptown. And in the process, we'll be starting a fund drive in February, which means that we will be asking you to help us out. Now, The Positive Mind will be put on an unusual schedule. It'll be on for 2 hours every week, two consecutive hours on the first week. It'll be on Tuesday, the second week on Wednesday, the third week on Thursday. You can see the schedule on the website or on Facebook. This is Armand DeMille. It's good to be with you, friends. Stick with us.
Everything must change. Nothing stays the same. Everyone will change. No one stays the same. Young become the old. Mysteries do unfold. For that's the way of time. Nothing and no one goes unchanged. There are not many things in life you can be sure of. Rain comes from the clouds, sun lights up the sky, hummingbirds do fly. Winter turns to spring, a wounded heart will heal, but never much too soon. But everything must change. The young become the old, mysteries do unfold, but that's the way the time, nothing goes unchanged. There are not many things in life you can be sure of, except rain comes from the clouds, sun lights up the skies, the hummingbird do fly. Rain comes from the clouds, sun lights up the sky, hummingbirds do fly. Rain comes from the clouds, sun lights up the sky, hummingbirds.
Randy Crawford.